Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Linter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Peter Hotez, vaccine scientist, pediatrician, and founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Texas. Dr. Hotez addresses the deadly consequences of a lack of a national public health strategy to tackle COVID-19 in the U.S., the rapid acceleration of vaccine discovery for this particular coronavirus strain, and the threat of vaccine hesitancy and distribution timelines moving forward. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of factcheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Peter Hotez here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Peter Hotez, founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and professor of pediatrics at the Baylor College of Medicine. He's the director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development. He served as U.S. science envoy to the Middle East and North Africa under President Obama and was president of the Sabin Vaccine Institute.
Dr. Hotez is author of more than 400 published papers and several books, including the newly released Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science, and Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism. Dr. Hotez is a member of the National Academy of Medicine, the National Institute of Health Council of Councils, and he's also a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Hotez, we welcome you to Conversations on Healthcare.
Many thanks for having me.
Well, thanks so much again. And, you warned us many months ago that things could get out of hand in the absence of a national strategy. And while there's been promising news about the vaccine in recent days, I think it's fair to say your worst projections are coming to pass. Infections and hospitalizations are skyrocketing along with the death toll. As someone who's on the front line of this pandemic in a major hotspot in Texas, I wonder if you could help our listeners understand what we're facing here in America around the pandemic's trajectory as we are heading into Hanukkah, Christmas, and the new year.
Yeah, well, thanks. In this transition time, I'd warned that things could really get out of hand because even when we had a functioning White House, there was no real national control program and it was left to the states. And now it seems like everything is evaporated. We're just seeing this very steep acceleration, getting to 200,000 cases per day. And remember what that number means. It means it's usually an underestimate times 4 or 5. So we're upwards to a million cases a day. And this is starting to overwhelm intensive care units across many parts of the country. And that's when the deaths really skyrocket, is when you start overwhelming health systems and piling people into ICUs on top of exhausted nurses and doctors and hospital staffs. And so in some ways, it really is a nightmare scenario. Some of the worst affected areas in the country and the world are in the United States. And for most of this fall, it's been the North Central U.S. and Texas, but now it's spreading outward. So now Rhode Island is getting hit very, very hard. And we're hearing news reports of what's going on in Rhode Island. Indiana is getting hit very hard. So it's pretty much now going to be a full-on national problem. It was kind of confined in the middle, mostly red states of people defiant of masks and social distancing. But it looks like it's just all over the U.S. And we'll hit 300,000 deaths probably next week and probably 400,000 deaths by the inauguration, which is a terrible number. It's the number of American GIs who lost their lives in World War II. And it'll keep going for a while until since without a national strategy, the approach now is to be relying 100% on biotechnology solutions, meaning vaccines pretty much. And that's where we're at. And so until we can start vaccinating the population, this awful trend will continue. I try to hold it off. I try to work with the White House over the summer to halt this fall surge because I knew how horrible it would be. I just couldn't gain any traction there.
Yeah. Dr. Hotez, that is obviously very sobering analysis. It speaks to the challenges wrought by the lack of a national strategy. But here we are. You say we need to brace for some very traumatic days ahead of us. But you've also said that there are three things we have to do right now to at least try and curtail the outbreak until a vaccine becomes widely available. So share, what are those three things that you think we just need to do right now to try and at least make a dent in this?
Well, to try to enforce, you know, to try to incentivize people, you know, what I like to say is there's a reason for doing this. If we can keep everybody alive for the next few weeks, get them to the other side, get them vaccinated, nobody has to lose their life, and things won't be back to normal, but it will be in a much better place in a few months. So this is especially tragic to lose the lives of loved ones over this period. So the message is, one, face masks, of course, and we've heard the president-elect Biden recommend 100-day wearing of masks, and clearly if we get to close to 100% mask wearing, that can make the difference of whether 300,000, 400,000, or 500,000 Americans have lost their lives by the time of the inauguration. So that's really important. I think the other is implementing aggressive social distancing in areas where we're starting to see surges on our ICUs, as demonstrated by positivity rates and hospital admissions and other measures. And more or less, that's what the governor of California has done. Gavin Newsom's recommending is he's going to do surgical strikes in areas where there's these deep surges. And I wish other parts of the country would adopt that. It's not the same as a national control program, but at least it gives our healthcare providers, our heroes, a chance to recover and be able to manage patients to the best they can. And then, of course, continued diagnostic testing is still a cornerstone. I'm not sure how effective contact tracing is at this point. It's just such a high level of transmission. And these are all stopgap measures, but at least it'll help limit loss of life to some extent until we can really roll out vaccinations in a more substantive way.
You know, I want to pull thread a little on vaccine development. You've been involved in that your whole career. It's often a very long and arduous process, but I think you rightly noted that the road to COVID-19 vaccine has been happening over 17 years since the SARS outbreak. But I wonder if you could talk to our listeners about the most recent sprint and the incredible rapid mobilization that's come about over this last year. But also, what should we keep our eye out in terms of data? It appears we know about the efficacy of the vaccine, but we don't know a lot about its effectiveness until it gets wider distribution into the general population. What are you keeping an eye on in terms of the data to give you some indication about its effectiveness or any issues that might arise?
Well, you're right. I think, you know, these vaccines, we often, you know, it's pretty much everything we know about these vaccines, unfortunately, is coming from company press releases. And as I often like to point out, when a CEO releases a press release from a company, it's not written for you, it's not written for me, it's written for the shareholders. And sometimes it's accurate, but sometimes it's not. Fortunately, I think the new latest ones from Pfizer and Moderna are roughly reflective of what the FDA is actually before them when they're making decisions about emergency use authorization. I think, you know, if you look at the big landscape, we'll have four or five, hopefully, vaccines by the spring. And that's going to be important because I don't think we're going to be able to vaccinate a significant percentage of the U.S. population with the two mRNA vaccines alone. I'm not certain that the technology is going to be robust enough, at least for this pandemic. It'll definitely improve over time, but I wouldn't want to rely totally on mRNA vaccines at this point, even if in the early stages they look effective. So what I'm looking at in the coming months is multiple vaccines, at least the two mRNA vaccines, probably two adenovirus-based vaccines from AstraZeneca, Oxford, and J&J. Maybe a particle vaccine from Novavax. We're accelerating a vaccine now being scaled up across India and tested. So that's very exciting. It's an older technology, uses a recombinant protein approach. They all work more or less by inducing what are called virus neutralizing antibodies. And that's what our work over the last 17 years more or less showed. If you can induce high levels of virus neutralizing antibody against the spike protein of the virus, you'll get vaccine protection. So the key is to for everybody to get virus neutralizing antibodies in their system, and don't overthink which vaccine you're going to take. They all do that. What we don't know is what the durability of protection is. How long will they protect? Will it be 3 months, 3 years, 30 years? And also whether the same safety spectrum that we've seen in 30, 40,000 person clinical trials will continue to hold as we start vaccinating tens of millions of people. But there is a good safety monitoring system in place. So the hope is as we move into the early spring, we'll start vaccinating a significant percentage of the population. It'll keep you out of the hospital and the ICU. And then if enough people get vaccinated in the country, we estimate now with a group at City University of New York, 60 to 80% of the U.S. population, potentially we could achieve interruption of transmission as well, which would be fantastic. But a lot of the stars will have to align in order to achieve that. We will need to have vaccines that stop asymptomatic transmission, and we don't know that yet from the performance spectrum of what we've seen in the phase three trials. Hopefully we'll get an understanding of that. We'll probably need adolescents and kids vaccinated in order to do that. We'll need a communication strategy to manage all the speed bumps, all the bumps in the road, because we're every day you're going to be hearing something, whether it's Bell's palsy from the Pfizer vaccine, or we heard about two allergic reactions and two people in the UK. That's got to be messaged, and we don't have a robust system of communication in place to manage that. We're hearing everything from the pharma CEOs who more often bungle the message. And then we have to counter the anti-vaccine lobby. And so far, just no one has shown any appetite for doing that. So we still have a lot of work to do to get to that second piece of interrupting transmission with widespread vaccination.
Well, Dr. Hotez, one of the stars that has to align, as you've indicated, is trying to hold down the tide of vaccine hesitancy. Certainly, you know that very well as a vaccine scientist, a pediatrician, and I know a self-described autism dad, which led you to perhaps write your book, Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism. And, you know, we have seen this around measles in particular, but also some other vaccines. And yet, the entire world has not had this shared experience in recent memory for anybody of dealing with a pandemic like this. What's your best sense of, will this be different? Will people be more willing to accept the vaccine against COVID because they've had this lived experience of seeing such widespread death in their communities and in the country? Or is there a key message for people to be getting now to try and blunt some of that vaccine hesitancy?
Well, it depends which day you ask me. There's some days where I'm quite optimistic we'll be able to overcome it. Other days I'm not. And that really does reflect some nuance of the news cycle. Most of the surveys that we have were collected data prior to having the efficacy results, knowing that we may have vaccines that are 95% protective. So I think, you know, the numbers showing up to half of Americans will refuse COVID-19 vaccines, even if they're made available. I think that number will shrink, you know, as the efficacy numbers are confirmed by the FDA, as we already have done for Pfizer with the emergency use authorization. And as people see their colleagues and friends and family get vaccinated with no untoward effect, I think the acceptance level will increase. Working against us is the fact that there will be these bumps in the road where we hear about allergic reactions or Bell's palsy, and without an appropriate level of government scientist communication to the American people, that will be amplified. It'll be amplified by the media and, of course, amplified by the anti-vaccine people. So, you know, after what's happened today, I'm less optimistic than I was yesterday, just on the basis because every adverse reaction that happens is being put out there without any kind of effort to contextualize it. And, you know, I do the best I can as a medical school professor talking on the cable news networks, but, you know, I don't have the accountability. I'm not a government scientist. So that's a problem. And of course, we've got this unfiltered, very aggressive anti-vaccine movement that dominates the internet. So hard to know how all this is going to play out.
We're speaking today with Dr. Peter Hotez, founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine. Dr. Hotez, in your new book, Preventing the Next Pandemic, you note that we should already be preparing for the next wave of deadly pathogens that are certainly to emerge. It seems like we've maybe every 10 years we've had SARS, then MERS, then we have COVID-19. And some nations have effectively thwarted bad outcomes with the pandemic, largely through effective public health strategies. Obviously, the United States has not. How do we move beyond this instructive moment to better prepare policymakers and global health practitioners for the next pandemic? And tell us more about your call for vaccine diplomacy in this time of anti-science to address this and really future challenges.
Yeah, within the U.S., I think this concept of a coronavirus task force, if nothing else we've learned, is a discredited concept. It's too politicized. You can't manage a pandemic or an epidemic out of Washington, D.C. I have an article that's been published now in Microbes and Infection, and it basically says it's got to be taken out of Washington. It's got to move to Atlanta. It's got to be put firmly in control by the Centers for Disease Control. They're the professional setup to do that. And if there have been lapses this year because they did miss the entry of the virus from Europe into New York and the debacle with the testing, so there are some structural issues that have to be fixed, but that needs to be prioritized and run it out of Atlanta, not Washington. I think that will help quite a bit and really create a national response and stop this nonsense of, hey, we just have to let the states be in the lead and with some backup FEMA support and supply chain management. That's a failed strategy. Globally, we have a lot of repairing work to do. We've got the U.S. has pulled out of the World Health Organization and the COVAX sharing facility for equity around COVID-19 vaccines. And we have the president's executive order this week saying it's America first, and which has no teeth to it anyway, because the contracts are already signed by the multinational companies. So we're going to have to fix that. And because right now in that gap, you have now the Russians and the Chinese making bilateral, bypassing usual vaccine governance mechanisms through WHO and negotiating one-on-one with bilaterally with the country. So it's got this kind of Cold War smell to it, working with the Latin American and countries, African countries for influence. So there's a lot of damage that has to be undone. It's all doable, but we're going to have to be a different type of country, really taking on control of our own epidemic and providing better leadership globally.
Well, Dr. Hotez, you introduced me to a new acronym, NTDs, for neglected tropical diseases, something that you put a lot of very important focus on and seen just so much suffering and harm come from a variety of preventable illnesses that have impacted some of the world's most marginalized and vulnerable populations. And I know you have a deep concern for health inequities here in the United States. And certainly during this pandemic, we've had concerns about disproportionate impact, higher death tolls in certain populations. There's questions of whether some of the most privileged COVID victims are getting access to better or earlier treatments, while others may not. What are your thoughts on how we move forward from here beyond COVID to address these systemic disparities in healthcare and outcomes in our own population here at home?
Well, there's no secret that the U.S. is one of the leaders in health disparities, unfortunately. We have one of the world's most expensive health systems, and yet one of the worst in terms of inequities and inefficiencies. So there's that larger structural issue. I think we haven't done enough to recognize the impact of COVID-19 on low-income neighborhoods and particularly the essential workers that comprise the Hispanic, African American, Native American communities. Even basic stuff, you know, with guidelines saying 65 and older, that was based on non-Hispanic whites, where only 13% were under the age of 65, but it's 35% among the Hispanic community. It's men and women in their 50s and early 60s. And so even simple things that don't cost us much more we can fix to save lives, and yet we just can't seem to keep all this on the radar screen. So I testified to the Congressional Hispanic Caucus over the summer and basically, you know, made that statement that we're experiencing historic decimation of Hispanic communities. Mm-hmm. You know, here in Houston, we get a death report from the people who've died the day before, the week before, and, you know, every day. It doesn't provide names, but it provides age, race, ethnicity, and sex, and it's every day Hispanic, 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 Hispanic going down the list. Mm-hmm. And this more or less goes on without comment. And it's not just Houston, it's across the southern cities and up into Chicago and places like that that have large Hispanic communities. This is largely unknown, and we're going to have to finally address this. I know the Biden administration has appointed someone to manage racial inequalities on the coronavirus task force, and I hope that we can elevate that kind of thing to a greater importance.
We hope so as well, and our thoughts are with all those who've lost their lives, and certainly the Black, Indigenous, people of color have been significantly impacted by the U.S.'s bungling of our response to the pandemic. But we have to figure out a strategy moving forward, and we'll shortly have a new administration. And President-elect Biden has set some ambitious goals. You mentioned 100 days of wearing masks, and also this effort to vaccinate 50 million Americans in his first 100 days. That's given that two are needed for each individual. I guess I ask the question, is this possible? And I ask that in part because the current administration hasn't developed a delivery system, the supply chain's in disarray. Everything's been left, as you said earlier, to 50 states, a terrible strategy. What keeps you up at night to get all people in America vaccinated to really implement this very important goal that the president-elect has laid out?
Well, I do think it is doable. Remember, every year we do a carefully orchestrated dance of vaccinating 85 million Americans against the flu. Mm-hmm. That starts around August and goes to the end of the year. Now, it's fewer people over a longer period of time, but it's not, you know, in terms of scope and magnitude, it's not that much different. I mean, it is more ambitious, and you have the problem, the fact that the first vaccines coming out have these onerous freezer requirements that make it more challenging. But it's certainly doable. I think, though, we're going to have to fix our deficits in communicating about vaccines. We just don't have good mechanisms for it. I know there's a plan to pay $50 million for public service announcements, and that'll help, but it's not enough. We're going to need mm-hmm. government scientists out in the lead. And then we have to do one other thing, which no one right now has an appetite for, and that is launch a counteroffensive against the anti-vaccine groups mm-hmm. that are deliberately targeting African-American communities.
Right.
And, you know, especially in academia, that makes people very uncomfortable, or in governments to do something like that. But, you know, treat it like we would terrorist organizations. I mean, it's killing a lot more Americans than terrorist groups ever have. So for that, I've recommended now creating an interagency task force to look at what are our levers that we have to do this. And in the past, we've left it to the Health and Human Services agencies that don't want to get involved. They've not seen the urgency of doing this. So I think it means bringing in Homeland Security. It means bringing in the State Department, because a lot of it's coming from Russia and Russian bots and mm-hmm. trolls. It means the Department of Commerce. And if we put our mind to it, we can and our political will to it, we can do a lot. And that's going to be necessary as well.
Yeah. We've been speaking with Dr. Peter Hotez, the founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and the director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development. Learn more about his work by going to peterhotez.org or follow him on Twitter at Peter Hotez or at Texas Children's. Dr. Hotez, we want to thank you so much for your dedication to advancing the science of vaccines, for your dedication to global health inequities, for your thought leadership during this pandemic, and for being such a steady and compassionate voice of reason and information throughout these many very difficult months. And thank you for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
A recent study in Denmark found that face masks did not have a large protective effect for wearers. It did not find that masks provide no protection at all or don't offer benefits to others, which is how some wrongly interpreted the results. The randomized controlled trial evaluated whether giving free surgical masks to volunteers and recommending their use safeguarded wearers from infection with the coronavirus, in addition to other public health recommendations. The study didn't identify a statistically significant protective effect for wearers, but the trial was only designed to detect a large effect of 50% or more, and the study didn't weigh in on the ability of masks to prevent spread of the virus from wearers to others, which is thought to be the primary way that masks work. As a result, the most that can be said is that this particular study, under the conditions at the time in Denmark, didn't find that the face mask intervention had a large protective effect for wearers. Social media posts, nevertheless, latched onto the study to wrongly claim that the trial, quote, proves masks offer no protection from COVID, or that masks, quote, don't work. Again, the study, published in November, only assessed the personal protective effect of a mask intervention, not the potential for masks to hamper spread of the virus to others. Around 6,000 people who left their homes for at least 3 hours a day participated, with approximately half being given a box of 50 surgical masks and being told to wear a mask whenever outside of their homes. The other half was not given masks or such a mask recommendation. The study was conducted at a time when Danish authorities were not recommending masks to the general public, so most people both groups would encounter were not likely to be masked. After a month, 1.8% of the people in the mask group had been infected with COVID-19, compared with 2.1% in the control group. The difference was not statistically significant. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
When Jennifer Staple Clark was a sophomore at Yale, an internship at the ophthalmology office turned out to be a life-transforming experience. She realized that many of the patients who had limited access to medical care were coming into the office with serious eye conditions that had gone past the point of reversing, leading to unnecessary blindness. What she launched from her dorm room 11 years ago was a local initiative to improve access to preventative eye care to the neediest population in her local community. Her vision quickly grew. Within 2 years, she took her organization, Unite for Sight, worldwide and has since turned it into one of the leading providers of global eye care in hundreds of communities around the world. Unite for Sight brings social entrepreneurs, public health experts, local eye surgeons, and volunteers together to bring eye care into some of the most underserved areas of the world. The motto at Unite for Sight is that local problems need local solutions, so they use each country's existing pool of ophthalmologists and eye surgeons to treat their local patients. They also train community health workers in each area they serve, thus removing traditional barriers to eye care experienced by many in extreme poverty, and also ensuring a continuum of care for all of the patients they serve. The community health workers provide education and transportation to get doctors to the patients' communities and patients to the hospital if surgery is indicated. Since its inception, Unite for Sight has served 1.4 million patients worldwide and restored eyesight to roughly 55,000 people, restoring not only their sight, but their dignity and ability to be productive members of their communities as well. Identifying a pressing medical need, using global health delivery models, and improving the quality of life by offering basic preventative eye care to those who had previously gone without. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.